Alrighty, hello again, everyone, and welcome to it. The Daily Caller podcast for 19th of July, 2019, the 50th anniversary of the last day before a human being ever walked on the moon. Think about it, 50 years ago today, nobody'd ever touched the moon before, and tomorrow, 50 years ago, they did. So, yeah, yay humans, and yay Americans. I'm Derek Hunter. Welcome to the program. You can email me, Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. You can send compliments, complaints, whatever you got. Send stories, questions. And if you want to enter to win a signed copy of the book by Kaylee McEnany, you can do that too. Actually, that's the only way you can do that. I suppose you could wire me some PayPal money and we could maybe work out a bribe. But otherwise, no, don't do that. You'd pay. I'd sell, but it would be for like thousands and it's not worth it. Just take your chances at winning. Yeah, so there you go. As a programming note, I will be again on WMAL in Washington, D.C. from 3 to 6 today. So live Eastern time. If you want to listen online through the streaming machine or if you're in the area and want to call in, it looks like it might be, fingers crossed, it could possibly be a slower news day. So we might do some more fun topics since it's Friday. And you got to do the kind of show that you do, so that you're filling in for. Okay, so let's get into it. The fecal storm is kind of dying down, although the media is desperately going to try and keep it alive. Over the chant, over the tweet, who would have thought one tweet that did not involve any racist language whatsoever would set off all the dog ears in the media. Oh my God, racism, 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 that 5 days later we'd still be talking about it. Technically, I suppose this is 6 days later, but whatever, you get the gist of it. You would think there's nothing else going on in the world, and in the media world, there really is little else going on. It's insane. Well, we have some audio, because after the rally in North Carolina, and the chants of send her home. And look, I look at this. I don't care what the chant was. It's a harmless chant, just like chanting BS at a referee or an umpire is a harmless chant. It's what happens when there's a group of people having a good time, partying, living it up, who are all kind of like-minded and getting along and having a good time. It happens at political rallies all the time. But you would have thought that Donald Trump had called for the murder of members of Congress and that the crowd was asking for their location so that they could go out and carry out that hit. That is not the case. Oh, by the way, another programming note. It's Friday. The second half of the program is the Molly Hemingway, Carrie Severino interview on their huge best-selling book, Justice on Trial. So you only get to hear me for about a half an hour before we get to the interview. So lucky you. So yes, the pearl clutching continues. It's a shocking thing that you would think that at some point when you're digging and you're digging and you're digging and you're losing viewers and you're losing ratings and maybe losing your job, you'd think, okay, we got to try something else. But that's not the way the mainstream media works. They're perfectly willing to preach exclusively to an ever-shrinking choir. This is about agenda advancing. It has nothing to do with journalism. There is nothing in Trump's tweet, there was nothing at Trump's rally, that would require more than, you know, 5-10 minutes of discussion on a serious news program. And then you would go on to the other news of the day. People are murdered. Horrible things happen. Good things happen. You didn't hear about any of those this week because of the media's obsession. Well, the president yesterday, in a little gaggle in the Oval Office, was asked about this and whether or not he regrets it. Now, some conservatives were saying he's walking back, he's squishing out. Others were saying he's doing the smart thing. It doesn't really matter, to be perfectly honest with you. In 3 weeks, in 2 weeks, maybe even in 1 week, nobody's going to remember any of this. And let's be honest, it's not as though they're not going to call Donald Trump racist again. They called John McCain a racist in 2008. They called Mitt Romney a racist in 2012. They called both of them misogynists. They called both of them every name in the book. They called George W. Bush a racist back in 2000. Remember the NAACP radio ad about James Byrd, the guy who was dragged to death by two or three racist pieces of crap? And George W. Bush did not sign vetoed hate crime legislation? What did the NAACP ad say? They had James Byrd's daughter saying that when George W. Bush refused to sign hate crimes legislation, it was like my father was killed all over again. Really? George W. Bush supported the death penalty for the murderers of your father. The NAACP didn't care. It was about winning an election. George W. Bush wasn't a racist. John McCain wasn't a racist. Mitt Romney wasn't a racist, and Donald Trump isn't a racist. This is their go-to default setting. If they thought that Bob Dole was a threat in 1996, they would have called him a racist, but they knew that they had that election in the bag, so they took one off and skipped it. So with all that in mind, here, let's listen to the President of the United States address this again. My God, if you had a chance to ask the President of the United States, this is what drives me nuts about media. He's been asked a variation of these questions since the tweet. He's gone out to Marine One and done little gaggles. This is well-covered ground. But the problem is, and the audio you're going to hear is of Jonathan Karl of ABC News. The problem for Jonathan Karl is, this is the first chance he's had to ask the question. And ABC News can't play audio of somebody from NBC News asking a question, so they all end up asking a variation of the same stupid question. And they get the same answer. And it's funny because they don't ever say that, well, the press continued to dog the president about the same old question. It's always, the president continued to dodge the answer to this question. Oh, he's giving the same answer. You just don't like the answer. You're asking the question that everybody else has asked. Note how nobody's asking Ilhan Omar any questions. Nobody's asking AOC any questions. It's all about Donald Trump. They can call Americans Nazis, concentration camp guards, the president Hitler, a puppet of Russia, the worst man ever, he's a threat to democracy, so on and so forth. Donald Trump hits back, and immediately it's, oh my God, he swiped back at a woman of color, and a woman of color. The narrative is set, and nothing deviates from that. Well, anyway, like I was saying, the president kind of walked back his statement. He disavowed it. And by the way, CNN said that he allegedly disavowed it. I don't know how you allegedly disavow. I'll tell you what CNN said in a second. First, let's listen to Donald Trump in the Oval Office today with Jonathan Karl from ABC News.
Why didn't you stop them? Why didn't you ask them to stop saying that?
Well, number one, I think I did. I started speaking very quickly. It really was a loud, I disagree with it, by the way, but it was quite a chant. And I felt a little bit badly about it, but I will say this, I did, and I started speaking very quickly, but it started up rather fast, as you probably know.
So you'll tell your supporters never to say
that
again?
Well, I would say that. I was not happy with it. I disagree with it, but again, I didn't say that, they did, but I disagree.
But they were echoing what you said in your first tweet, that they should go back.
Well, I don't think if you examine it, I don't think you'll find that, but I disagree with it. Anybody else?
Well, there you go. The president couldn't have been more clear. He disagrees with it. He'll stop it in the future. He stopped it pretty quickly. He started talking. Normally, when they chant lock her up, he sort of walks around the stage, enjoying it, soaking it up. This time, CNN, of course, took a stopwatch to it. They wanted to know exactly. It turns out 13 seconds. 13 seconds, and they're asking, oh my God, that he did not put a stop to it pretty quickly. He waited a whole 13 seconds. Yeah, a whole 13 seconds. You know what happens in a crowded room like that when a chant starts with thousands of people? The person on stage may not hear it. The chant may start way in the back. Guess what's way in the back? cameras and crowd microphones. Guess what would pick it up before you're able to discern what in the hell is going on up on the stage? Yeah, you can figure out what's being said on camera much more quickly than you can in the moment on stage. So 13 seconds while they act like it is some huge scandal over at CNN, it's really not. Jake Tapper, here's Jake Tapper's tweet. You know, I feel bad every time I say good things about Jake Tapper because then he does something like this. It's not the story itself. It's the framing of the story. Then the story is rotten, too, because of the frame. Jake Tapper tweeted, quote, Trump claims to disavow racist chant after pressure from allies. He claims to disavow? First of all, I don't buy that it's a racist chant. But that's neither here nor there. It doesn't matter. Like I said, in a week, this will be forgotten. But the Trump claims to disavow. You just heard it. Did Trump disavow it or not? Jake Tapper had access to that exact same audio. Did he disavow it or not? It's pretty clear that he did disavow it. You know who isn't disavowing their ridiculous rhetoric? The woman, one of the women, one of the gang of four that's running around going, we need additional security. We're scared for our lives. Everything is so bad. Oh, because they chanted mean things about me. This is horrible. I don't know that I could ever show my face anywhere in public again. And I say, go ahead and put on a burqa. Who cares? Don't show your face. Ilhan Omar was greeted like a conquering hero by the members of the media and given a platform to spew her racism and her hatred of the country and of the President of the United States unfiltered and unchallenged yesterday up on Capitol Hill. This is one of the faces of the Democratic Party. The president right there said, I don't believe, you know, that was wrong. I disagree with it. I would have stopped it if I'd known what was going on. I stopped it as quickly as I knew what was going on. And in the future, I'll stop it sooner, so on and so forth. Ilhan Omar, instead of dialing it back, because everybody's right now in the president needs to dial back his rhetoric. Well, what about the left-wing a-holes who are calling him Hitler? They don't have to dial it back at all. Here's Ilhan Omar from yesterday.
We have said this president is racist. We have condemned his racist remarks. I believe he is fascist. I want to remind people that this is what this president and his supporters have turned our country, that is supposed to be a country where we allow democratic debate and dissent to take place. And so this is not about me. This is about us fighting for what this country truly should be.
She's a real hero, that Ilhan Omar. She is willing to go to the mattresses for what this country should be, like a socialist country where individual liberty bows down at the throne of government. I don't think she really understood her citizenship classes all that well, to be perfectly honest with you. But when everybody's a hero, the hero, in their own story. And that's what we're seeing here. It is, she's a victim and she's a hero. I'm not sure you can effectively be both simultaneously, and I know she can't effectively be a hero because she is fighting for the cause that is a cause that is anti-American, to be perfectly honest with you. But was she questioned? Was she challenged? Well, how is the president a fascist? That's a very simple question. I repeat myself often because it bears repeating. And one thing I think that absolutely bears repeating is on the sliding scale of politics from left to right. Everybody agrees liberals want bigger government and more control. That's not a value judgment, that's just a statement of fact. And everybody agrees that conservatives on the right want smaller government and more individual liberty. Where on God's green earth does somebody get the idea that if you go further to the right, somehow as government shrinks and individual liberty goes, there's this weird little blip that is complete fascism, because fascism is essentially near complete control, varying degree. I mean, the degrees of difference between socialism, communism, and fascism are not worth mentioning. They're not really all that different. But somehow, if you go towards what would logically be on the right, if you went all the way to the end, no government and complete individual liberty, which would ultimately, probably given human nature, become anarchy, right before you get to there, there's this giant blip in the other direction that says, oh, by the way, no government, small government, small government, smaller government, huge government, massive control, small government, no government. It doesn't make any sense. Just thinking about it logically, fascism is and always has been a fever dream of the left. It is what it is. They want socialism. The people won't give them socialism, so they implement fascism to basically implement socialism by force. That ultimately becomes a purity issue, and you end up in full-blown communism. But Ilhan Omar isn't asked to explain how it is that somebody advocating for smaller government is a fascist. She doesn't seem to. No one in the media seems to think that that's a problem or that there's a disconnect. To illustrate this point, I have one more clip on this topic before we move on. Joy Behar. Now, it scares me and makes me weep a little bit as an American to know that there are some of my fellow citizens out there who get their news from The View. It is a horrifying proposition, to be perfectly honest with you. There isn't one person on that show, even as a guest, that is worth their weight in dog excrement. But they get a large enough audience to still continue to exist, even though they embarrass the hell out of ABC News, as many stories have documented. Well, they brought this issue up. They brought the idea and the rally up and the chanting, and Whoopi Goldberg was beside herself. And what Whoopi says would normally have warranted comment, but we're just going to play it and let it speak for itself. Because what Joy Behar says next is so incredibly stupid and so incredibly anti-American. Dare I say fascistic? And this, again, lets you know that fascism is not only an eventuality as you move further to the left, it is the natural habitat for many of our so-called progressive friends. Don't believe me? Listen to this.
Doesn't acknowledge the fact that what he is doing is possibly inviting violence towards these women and women who are saying, this is wrong, I don't like this.
No question.
This involves every female in this country.
Well, why can't, can we show the TV he be brought up on charges of hate speech?
Sorry.
Why can't he be sued by the ACLU for hate speech? I don't get it.
Have you ever heard something so dumb and horrifying at the same time? Why can't he be brought up on charges of hate speech? Why can't the ACLU sue him for hate speech? This is their instinct. He said stuff. We must punish him. Sadly, this is what's going on all across Europe. You can be punished and imprisoned for your tweets and for your Facebook posts. It's happened in New Zealand. It's happening around the world. The United States of America, thankfully, has, or at least still has, a First Amendment that protects people and their ability to say damn near anything they want. But if the Joy Behars, if the progressive left were to ever get power, full power, absolute power, how long do you think this country would turn into the biggest college campus on the planet with speech codes? Maybe we'd be blessed with a free speech zone, but the fairness doctrine would be reinstated. It would be applied to cable news, even though the FCC has no domain over cable news because it's not broadcast over the air. They would just assert it. They would just find a way to do it because they hate dissent. They hate criticism. And they will use the power of government and the threat of prison and the point of a gun to squash it. So yeah, Joy Behar, why can't we just arrest him? Why can't we charge him with hate speech? Why can't the ACLU sue him for hate speech? And there are millions of people across the country who watch The View who go, yeah, Joy, why can't we do that? If it doesn't scare you, I don't know what would scare you. That's a horrifying proposition. Yet it is their instinct. No one on that panel jumped up and said, "Oh, well, this is ridiculous. How dare you even suggest such a thing?" Nope. They just wondered, why? Why? Yeah, you know what? Let's get the ACLU on the case. Their totalitarian instincts know no bounds, ladies and gentlemen. They know no bounds whatsoever. In other news, there was the big, it was the lamest draft ever. CNN held a live, I'm not going to bore you with any of the video or the audio, but they held a live drawing to determine who was going to participate in which night of the next round of debates. There's another round of debates. Tuesday, July 30th and Wednesday, July 31st in my hometown of Detroit. Yeah, way to go, Detroit. Well, it kind of is breaking down into another kiddie table situation, even though Bernie is on the other night. The first night of debates, here's the lineup. I'll just give it to you really quickly. It's Sanders and Warren, Buttigieg, O'Rourke, and his stunning fall from grace, Klobuchar, hippie guru Marianne Williamson, John Delaney, John Hickenlooper, Tim Ryan, and Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, is filling up the slot that that Eric Swalwell missed, that he left. He'll be missed. On night two, it's the sort of upper table night. It's Biden, Kamala Harris. I wonder if she'll try and bring up something. You know, do you remember the last time when I talked about busing? Try and relive that moment. Castro, Andrew Yang, Cory Booker, Jay Inslee, Kirsten Gillibrand, Tulsi Gabbard, Michael Bennett, and Bill de Blasio. I don't know. They really should separate them by polling numbers now that I think about it. I thought it would be interesting to see them mix it up, but they don't really mix it up. When you agree with 99% of what the other person is saying, and you're arguing over how quickly you're going to implement socialism, it's not the most compelling television I've ever heard. But that's your big debate. I'll watch it. I'll check it. If I remember, I'll check it out. But again, when you're 6 months before the time anybody's going to vote, not really sure that it's going to have the massive impact that it did. The only thing interesting to watch is whether or not Bernie continues to sort of be an angry rambler, and whether or not Joe Biden just continues to be a rambler. There's reports that after the last debate, after he did such a horrible job, that he hired a debate coach. Speech coach, somebody to sort of wake him up. They'll probably just have someone on staff give him a Viagra or a little toot of cocaine or something, because at least a cup of coffee, Joe, at least a cup of coffee, for the love of God. Alrighty, so tomorrow, before we get to the interview, we got the interview coming up. Tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of probably certainly one of the greatest achievements in all of human history, the moon landing. It was before I was born, but I have been fascinated by the moon for a long time. When I was writing really cheesy, god-awful, terrible poetry in college, I would write about the moon a lot. And you just think about what was accomplished and what it was accomplished with. The computer technology that we have now is light years ahead of what they had then, yet they were able to accomplish that. I don't know that we could accomplish it now, to be perfectly honest with you. Even with all the computing technology that we have, I'm not really sure that anybody could do the double-checking human math anymore. But as we build up to this anniversary, and it's a significant anniversary, 50 years, Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins are still with us. Neil Armstrong passed away a few years ago. All media outlets are sort of, you know, doing their anniversary coverage, getting ready for it, doing commemorative issues. What was it like at the time? And I find it horribly interesting. I've been watching all these documentaries, as I mentioned yesterday's program, about this. And then you have the New York Times that just can't let it go. You never notice how liberals are absolutely miserable human beings. They really, truly are. I call it Michael Stipe's disease, but you could pick any of them. As long as somebody is suffering somewhere, you call it AOC's disease. as long as somebody could be suffering somewhere, how can you have any fun anywhere? It is inappropriate. So as the world prepares to mark the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, the New York Times decided that this would be a good time to apply current PC garbage to the moon landing. In a 9-page spread the other day, that's what it prints up is 9 pages. It's under the banner essay. The headline says it all. It's by somebody named Mary Robinette Kowal, K-O-W-A-L. The headline and subheadline say it all. To make it to the moon, women have to escape Earth's gender bias. And then the subheadline, first of all, if you're already not ready to throw up, the subheadline is, the Apollo program was designed by men for men, but NASA can learn from its failures as it aims to send women to the moon and beyond. NASA can learn from its failures. We're celebrating the 50th anniversary of NASA's greatest achievement, human beings' greatest achievement. And here is the New York Times trying to take a giant crap all over it by saying, they were sexist. We got to get women up to the moon. I thought Ralph Cramden had that covered in the 50s. Alice didn't want to go, so they found men who were willing to strap themselves to what was essentially a nuclear missile where the warhead was replaced by them. These people are unbelievable. And if you thought that that was stupid, and it is, they decided to outdo themselves with this one. This one from yesterday is entitled, How the Soviets Won the Space Race for Equality. The subheadline, the USSR sent women and people of color to space years before the US. Yes, but were they sent willingly? See, because in the Soviet Union, you were a ward of the state, your property. Just read this first paragraph, because that lets you know how sick these people are. The Cold War was fought as much on an ideological front as a military one, and the Soviet Union often emphasized the sexism and racism of its capitalist opponents, particularly the segregated United States. Whereas if you look at the pictures of the Politburo from the old Soviet days, it's nothing but people of color and women from coast to coast, right? And the space race was a prime opportunity to signal the USSR's commitment to equality. After putting its first man in... I just love that last line. It was a chance for the USSR to signal their commitment to equality. Yes, everyone was treated equally. You were all property of the state. You were all disposable. You were all expendable. The left, they really are just a messed up group of people. Just sick, sick minds. All right, so to commemorate, in case you were like me and not alive then, or maybe you were alive then and you just want to relive it, I just have a couple of clips from the actual moon landing. I just want to show you how the news... It's kind of a news break sort of thing. ABC News did 30 hours of coverage straight, live, straight. They didn't broadcast after like 10 or 11 o'clock back then, I didn't think. Nobody did. But for the moon landing, they made an exception. This is how ABC News set it up.
Good day from ABC Space Headquarters in New York. It is July 20th, 1969, and man is about to land on the moon. Eagle will touch down approximately 4 hours and 17 minutes from now, if the flight plan as it is now established goes forward as scheduled.
From there, some 4 hours and 16 minutes later, we pick it up as the lunar landing module starts to get close to the moon. The only thing I cut out of this was the silence. There was long periods of silence, but this is as it happened otherwise.
Eagle, Houston, we see you on a steerable, over.
Roger, Eagle, I'm got.
Roger, how does it look?
Eagle has wings.
Roger.
Okay, all flight controllers, go, no go for landing. Retro.
Go.
Fido.
Go.
Guide.
Go.
Control.
Go.
Telcom.
Go.
GNC.
Go.
Ecom.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Capcom, we're go for landing.
Altitude 4200.
Houston, you're go for landing, over.
Roger, understand, go for landing, 3,000 feet.
You're looking great.
How you doing, Control?
We look good here, fine.
How about you, Telcom?
Go.
Guidance, you happy?
Go.
Fido.
Go.
2,000 feet, 2,000 feet. Into the ag, 47 degrees.
Roger.
47 degrees.
Still looking very good.
Here go.
Alarm. 1201.
1201.
Roger, 1201 alarm.
1201 alarm.
Stand tight, we're go flight.
Okay, we're go.
We're go, same high, we're go.
Altitude 1600.
Eagle looking great. Roger, 1202, we copy it.
35 degrees, 750, coming down to 23. 540 feet, down to 15. 1050 feet, down at 4. Altitude, velocity, light. 3.5 down, 220 feet. 11 forward, coming down nicely, 200 feet. 4.5 down, 5.5 down. 100 feet, 3.5 down, 9 forward. 875 feet, guys looking good, down a half. 6 forward.
60 seconds.
Light on, forward. Forward, 40 feet, down 2.5. Picking up some dust. Great shadow. 4 forward, drifting to the right a little.
30 seconds.
Forward, just... Contact light. Okay, engine stop.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The Eagle has landed. The first words spoken from the surface of the moon. I can't imagine what it was like to be alive then, watching this on television, looking outside, trying to look up at the moon. I think this happened in the middle of the night in the United States, trying to look up and see if you could see anything, even though you couldn't see anything. Maybe with a telescope you could. It had to be absolutely thrilling. And the pride and patriotism that would be flowing through Americans' veins at that time had to be off the charts. And just human beings in general. My God, a human being had made it to the moon. Doesn't matter where you're from. A human being had made it to the moon. And then, of course, everybody knows this.
That's one small step for man.
At that moment, a human being, an American, set foot on the surface of the moon, joined some 20 minutes later or whatever it was by Buzz Aldrin. They planted the flag, they collected rocks, they spent a few hours on the moon, and then they came back and rendezvoused with Michael Collins in the capsule circling the moon in orbit, waiting to pick them up, and they made it back safely to Earth. It was an amazing achievement. I tell you, you can find it out there online, and I recommend reading it. It's very interesting. There was the famous story that Nixon had a speech prepared, a statement, just in case. They had no idea if this was going to go horribly wrong, if they were able to get them back. It was, you know, probable, but there's still a high possibility of things going horribly wrong. So President Nixon had a prepared statement just in case they weren't able to get off the surface of the moon. It's worth reading. It's been read a lot, so I'm not going to do that. I don't have a whole lot of trivia about the moon landing, except that there's one famous photograph taken by Michael Collins, who remained in orbit around the moon, as the Eagle craft was descending to the moon, and you can see in the horizon the Earth, the giant, beautiful blue marble of the Earth, contrasted with the blackness of space and the grayness of the moon and the silver of the capsule. And it's a weird, interesting bit of trivia, but I can't remember where I read it from, that Michael Collins photograph, he is the only human being who has ever lived up until that time who isn't in that photograph, because you've got Aldrin and Armstrong in the capsule going down, and then you've got the Earth. Everybody's there. Everybody who's ever been is still there in part somewhere. So I thought that was kind of a neat bit of trivia. I was lucky enough to meet Buzz Aldrin a couple times and get his autographs in some books. Didn't have riveting conversations with him. There was a lot of people and we're moving everything through, but it was a thrill to meet someone like Neil Armstrong. It is amazing what they did 50 years ago tomorrow. So make sure you mark that moment and tell your kids, tell your friends, remind people of what this country can do, what our species can do when we put our minds to it. Because damn, they're really, if we can go to the moon on 1960s technology and get back, there ain't much we can't do. Speaking of innovation, we have a word from our sponsor and my former employer and my friends at Americans for Tax Reform. When President Trump says,
America will never be
a socialist country.
He couldn't be more right. That's why it's so troubling that a proposal from the Department of Health and Human Services would move us in that direction. The International Drug Pricing Index would adopt socialist price controls set by foreign countries. Today, Americans get access to cutting-edge therapies for diseases like cancer nearly 2 years before other countries. I talk about it regularly on the show. And the future holds incredible promise for fighting diseases like Alzheimer's and MS. The HHS proposal would cripple America's world-leading medical innovation. We would have fewer new cures, and they'd be harder to obtain. We should control costs with market reforms by fostering competition and by making other countries pay their fair share, not with socialist price controls here. Keep America great by keeping American medical innovation great. Visit protectmypartb.org. That's protectmypartb.org. Okay, that'll do it for me today. The interview with Carrie Severino and Molly Hemingway is coming up. Very interesting talk about their big best-selling book, Justice on Trial, about the Kavanaugh hearings. You will definitely enjoy it. You'll learn a lot of things, and you'll probably be inspired to go out and buy a copy of that book. So make sure you listen to that. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. Thanks for giving us a great week here, meaning me and my daughter Quinn, who's become obsessed with something called PJ Masks, and she's staring at it right now. I have no idea what it is, but it seems harmless enough. So, yes, we'll be back here on Monday. You can email me, Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at dailycaller.com. Thank you. Have a great weekend. Stay cool if you're anywhere where this heat wave is. And now here you go. Here is the weekly Daily Caller interview.
All righty. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Caller podcast, the Friday video edition. As we do always, we thank you for listening. Thanks for watching. However this is getting into your head, we appreciate the hell out of it. And as we do every Friday, we bring in real people from their lives who've done things that are much better than we could ever aspire to, and ask them, pick their brains, find their knowledge. And we have two today, so we got double the pleasure. We're joined by Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino. And I pronounced it?
Severino.
Severino. I have dyslexia, so I can claim that as an excuse. The new book, I'm just going to go and declare it a bestseller. Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. Congratulations on the book, first of all. I have to know, before we get into the substance of the book and the drama that was the confirmation, how'd the book idea come about? Which one of you came up with it?
Well, so we knew this was one of the most important things that happened to the country last year, and we both knew that there were real stories there that hadn't been told. So Molly was covering it as a journalist. I was working on it more from the inside from a group that was trying to advance the nomination. And we knew there were important stories out there to be told, and finally decided to team up because it really, I think, maximized both of our strengths knowing it. We had a lot of access to some of the key players as a result of what we had, the work we had done before. And that meant we could talk to people like the president and the vice president, people in the White House counsel's office, many members of the Supreme Court. We had dozens of senators and their staff. And then people that knew the Kavanaughs or people that knew Christine Blasey.
You did more than 100 interviews for this.
Oh, yes. Hundreds of hours. We
interviewed more than 100 people. And many of the people that we interviewed, we did many interviews with each of them.
And multiple hours of interviews. Really.
So how do you sit down and, like, it was a huge drama. How do you decide? How do you whittle the list of people? And who surprised you the most that they said, yes, I'll sit down with you. You talk to Supreme Court. You talk to the President of the United States. I mean, when you send that request out, you think, oh, you got to do it. You got to check that box, blah, blah, blah. And you get the call back. The President is willing to sit down with you.
So it was such an interesting work of reporting, and I am the reporter. Carrie doesn't even have that background, but she turned out to be
the Judicial Crisis
Network. I just had a very intensive apprenticeship in reporting over the last.
But she did an amazing.
Get away as quickly as you can.
I'm on the other side
life.
Of the microphone, so it was a neat.
But no, she did an absolutely amazing job, and part of it was just about, we did know because we had been involved in it. We already knew who some of the key figures were, and we did talk to some of them first to kind of lay out a general overview of what happened and what we're going to want to get into. But every single interview that we did, you would get these little breadcrumbs about who else you might want to talk to or who else might have a good story. And so it was just about taking our core team and then people that we wanted to interview and then building out from each of them. And the thing I really liked about it is people will tell you their perspective on a particular thing that happened. And as enough people tell you their perspective, you start to get a really you know, it's like that tale of the elephant being described from different angles, you start to get an idea of what's happening in a way that people don't even intend to tell you the details.
The Jeff Flake compromise.
So, right, that's where, and it happens in this anteroom outside of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing room. And you have all these senators that are packed into this tiny space. Some of them are secreted away in the tiny bathroom. You've got Jeff Flake and Senator Coons wrapped up in this tiny phone booth trying to negotiate everything. And then outside of those, in the hallway, but still in the room, it has a hallway and all the thing.
Oh, I've
You've got people
in the center. That's a mess.
You have people actually nearly coming to blows in anger over some of the shenanigans that have been
deployed. Staffers or Senate?
Senators.
Senators.
So there are staffers that are in there. The senators are constantly trying to get the staffers out, but there's no room for them to go. And outside of the room, people are trying to get in. So it's just, it gets up to be like 100 degrees. And when we first heard people talk about it, we thought, this sounds absurd. And by the 20th person that we talked to who was there was like, this just sounds like the craziest thing that's ever happened.
And when you've got dozens of people there, there's a lot of different
right,
of
yes.
that story.
And so what was the most surprising? What did you learn while doing this?
It's hard to even, you know, there's so many really fascinating moments. I would come home at the end of the day and be like, I can't believe we learned this.
Yes.
I think one of the things I really enjoyed was getting to see the human side of the Kavanaugh family. It was really even starting from the beginning when they're being chased by the press. And remember how everyone was camping out in front of Amy Coney Barrett's house, and they're camping out in front of the Kavanaugh's house too. And they decided, they didn't even know if he was going to get the nomination yet, but they said, we just have to leave the house. So they actually had to sneak out through this backyard path. They hid their clothes in the neighbor's treehouse so no one would see them leaving with suitcases or something, and then just camped out in a friend's house for the duration, not knowing yet even. They packed what, you know, what they would need if they had to go to the White House for an announcement, but didn't even know yet. And then, of course, following it through, just the trauma of having, of learning about the allegations, how you carry on your life. I mean, you've got these two girls in school, bringing them to school, trying to make sure that there aren't any outbursts there. And the surrounding community was incredibly supportive, actually. Obviously not all on the same political side.
Right.
I think it was a wide variety.
I used to live in his neighborhood when this all happened. I was like, he must live down there because it's just a mess.
Well, and really that whole, I mean, it's amazing how consistent the community has been over the years, because there's people who live there who they all went to high school with, you know, and that it's still very much a local story because everyone is there who knew them both growing up.
Their report, Mrs. Kavanaugh, did they want this? Did he want this? Did Mrs. Kavanaugh want this? It had to know that this, especially now, especially under President Trump and the way that the left has been acting since Election Day or even before, that anybody he picks is going to get a hellstorm. The nomination of not Brett Kavanaugh, the other justice whose name eludes me.
Merrick Garland?
No, not Merrick Garland.
Neil Gorsuch.
Yes.
Was relatively calm, although the Democrats made the nuclear option necessary, but otherwise it wasn't a circus. But you had to know that this one was going to be different. It was replacing the swing vote on the Supreme Court. How much did Kavanaugh want this? How much did Mrs. Kavanaugh want this?
We get into that in the book,
Injustice
on Trial. And it is one of the things we did learn was that Ashley Kavanaugh actually prays that Brett Kavanaugh will not get the nomination. She knows he's the most qualified. She supports him on that grounds. But it wasn't even about it being a Trump nominee. It was just that they had gone through this process twice before, and it had been absolutely brutal. During the George Bush administration, he was nominated for the court that he served on for 12 years, the D.C. Circuit Court, and he had to go through that confirmation battle twice because he didn't make it through the first time and he had to be renominated. And he had a lot of his, you know, he had Democratic senators who were frustrated because he had served on the Whitewater Council and they were still angry and sore about that. And so they had found that process to be particularly difficult. Brett Kavanaugh kind of took it as he didn't expect it, that he would be the nominee. He knew that he was so close to the Bush administration that might be a problem for President Trump. So he just had the attitude, I will put my best foot forward. I will answer every question. I will do the best work I can. You know, if I'm not chosen, I'm not chosen, but I'm going to put all the effort into it.
Why was he chosen over the others? There were other people who were thought, Amy Coney Barrett, that's clearly the one. Mm-hmm. Why was Brett Kavanaugh the ultimate choice?
Well, one of the interesting things we learned in doing all the research for Justice on Trial was that actually his name is mentioned well before this nomination. In fact, before Trump was even elected, he was one of, if you recall, the day that Justice Scalia died, there was a Republican debate, and Trump really shocked the nation by standing up there and not just saying, I want to, with whatever Republican presidential would-be nominee has said, well, I will appoint people in the mold of Justice Scalia and the mold of Justice Thomas or who love the Constitution. He actually got up there and gave names, and he said, I'd appoint someone like Bill Pryor or like Diane Sykes. And people said, did he just name check a couple of people? And actually, Kavanaugh's name had been mentioned in this discussion he had with his White House counsel, Don McGahn, over who would you name. So that was really interesting. They didn't choose to mention him at the time, partly because he was in D.C. They were trying to focus their campaign on people who were not, you know, not in the on the coasts and kind of real America. And that was where Pryor and Sykes fit that mold perfectly. And partly because also the connections with the Bush White House. But it was someone that was always in the back of their minds as this guy is a real stellar person and someone that came up a lot because he wasn't on the first list or its expansion that people would say, now, wait a minute, here's someone who really ought to be on this list. And he did ultimately add him to the list in November 2017. He was someone who had not just a long record in the D.C. circuit, and that's something that any Republican president nominating someone now wants to see. They've kind of learned from David Souter, who famously came on as a total blank slate and then turned out to be one of the most liberal justices on the court. So we want someone with a record. We want someone who can articulate originalism. But one of the real distinguishing factors of the Trump list and those kind of nominees is it's someone who also has had opportunities to stand up in difficult cases and to make their mark. This isn't someone who's going to just keep their powder dry or try to keep their beliefs secret. And Kavanaugh really had that. He had some very impressive decisions on his D.C. circuit. So in one of the strongest Second Amendment cases that there had been, which is actually in a follow-on to the famous Heller case that the Supreme Court decided, he had some really strong cases about the overgrowth of the administrative state, which is a big focus of the Trump administration, where you've got these administrative agencies with no supervision, out of control, out of the constitutional system. And he had written some cases that in the D.C. circuit meant being in dissent. But his theories and his concerns about the separation of powers actually were that of ultimately adopted by the Supreme Court. That was something that was really impressive, that he stood up for those principles and then also was able to articulate in a way that they were ultimately vindicated by the Supreme Court.
Molly, you look like you wanted to.
No, I was going to add some of that, but you got it in there. So.
Well, let me ask you this about the President of the United States. I assume he didn't have any relationship prior, probably never met Brett Kavanaugh before the nomination. During this process, what did the president think of Brett Kavanaugh?
Well, as we're interviewing people, we learn more about who stayed strong throughout the nomination process and who did not. And one of the things that is intriguing, given recent Republican White House handlings of these things, is the one area that the Kavanaugh team never felt they had to worry about was the White House. Partly that was about Donald Trump. Partly that was about Don McGahn, the White House counsel. They were just steadfast. They understood that there would be bumps along the road, that there would be problems, that there might be, you know, a last-minute smear campaign of some kind. But they were steadfast. That was not the case necessarily with senators. Some of the senators were quite helpful in advancing the nomination. Others were not. But as far as President Trump, he made his decision, and he did not agonize over the decision, but he definitely thought deeply about the decision. He had a bunch of really good finalist candidates. So in a way, he could have picked any of them and they would have been fine. But he goes with his sense that it needs to be Kavanaugh. And once he makes his determination, he is steadfast with it.
Take us into the thinking of that second hearing. We'll get to Blasey Ford in a second. But the hearing was a media circus. It was a disaster. The Republicans had the prosecutor asking the questions to begin with. Then there's that moment that every conservative remembers where Lindsey Graham suddenly says, enough of this. I'm reclaiming my time. And he just rips. I've never seen that passion from Lindsey Graham before. That seemed to change the tone, not only of Lindsey Graham forever since, but of every Republican who came after him, who did the same sort of thing to a much less degree. What was that moment like for the people that were participating in it that you spoke to and the people around that circle? Was that the moment that it clicked or what?
Well, one of the really fascinating things is that we learned is how the transfer of questioning happened with Rachel Mitchell to the senators. Because at the time, it wasn't really clear that, is she going to ask all the questions of Kavanaugh too? How is that going to happen? And so I don't think people knew if it was just that Lindsey Graham was fed up and just said, darn it, get that woman out of here, we're doing this. Or it turns out Mitchell, so she was a really amazing person to learn more about. But she went into this whole thing thinking, I am not here to just convict someone. I want to actually learn the facts here. That's what she does is her job. She is known for doing forensic investigations and understanding what the facts are to determine whether you can bring a case in court or not. So she wanted to be very careful about this. So she disappointed some people in not being as gung-ho as they were hoping, but ultimately brought out a lot of inconsistencies in the facts that turned out to be crucial to some of those undecided votes who were all important. But she didn't have a lot that she could do in terms of questioning Kavanaugh, because if he says he wasn't there, and there's not a specific, you know, there's not that much of a specific date, so you can only go so much into, right. Well, where were you during the entire summer of 82? And my gosh, of all people in the nation who actually know where they were during the summer of 1982, Brett Kavanaugh has a pretty, it was amazing. I'm sure people are going, really, I can't believe we picked the one guy to pull this on that has calendars in detail. But, you know, so she knew you can't fill up a half an hour with just that. So she really only had a few questions for him and then was getting ready to hand it over and they didn't even go through like who do I look at? So she kind of, right before it was Grahamster and happened to be looking over, and I can't remember if she connected eyes with Grassley or with Graham and just kind of indicated, I'm done. And then, boy, he I think, after watching this and after being someone where his policy, and was really one of the few left among the Republican senators who said, I'm just going to kind of vote for everyone as long as they're marginally qualified, you know, I mean, I'm sure he would say more qualified than that. As long as they're qualified, I'll vote for them, right? And he said that in his thing. He's like, look, I have been reaching out to you guys for decades. He voted for Kagan. He voted for Sotomayor, as he says. He voted for all of them, and there's no reciprocity. In fact, the Democrats were incredibly poorly behaved in this whole process, from hiding the allegations, from the way they were playing politics behind the scenes that we also, you know, go into a little bit. So that was something that I think he just was feeling for so long watching it that exploded there. And I think it tapped into things that a lot of other Americans were also feeling and kind of made them have permission to express that frustration as well.
Yes, but it wasn't just that he'd been slimed that day. He'd been slimed for weeks leading up to it, and there had been no defense of it. You know, nobody had defended Brett Kavanaugh except for the guy who runs the committee, Charles Grassley, at the beginning, and when the testimony opened. And nobody had been defending him for weeks as his name was being dragged through the mud through all these media stories that were lacking substance, were lacking evidence, and yet the media narrative was just running wild. So when he comes out, well, first when Kavanaugh delivers his testimony, but then when Graham does this thing, cathartic is exactly how I would describe it, too.
It was unprecedented for a Supreme Court nominee to give a media interview, but he sat down with Martha McCallum. What was the thinking behind that? Where did that originate from? Was the White House briefed ahead of time? Tell us the story behind that.
Right.
That was pivotal.
Yes, it is. I'm glad that you know that this has never been done before. There were so many things that happened in this confirmation battle that had never been done before. A Supreme Court nominee being on TV to give an interview, I mean, it's just something that decades ago...
It's hard enough to get a Supreme Court justice for an interview, let alone a nominee.
Decades ago, Supreme Court nominees wouldn't even address anything. It was really a testament to how bad the situation was that the team felt that an interview was necessary. They realized pretty early on, you've got, yes, he did his hearings a few weeks, or, you know, by that point, a few weeks prior. Not that many people were paying attention. Most of the narrative was about the chaos of those hearings. Then you've got weeks of unending smears again. So they knew they needed to get him out in front of the American people just so people could remember who he was and see him on his own terms and not as the media were describing him. But we do get into it in Justice on Trial about who the different people were who were trying to get that nominee, why they ended up going with Martha McCallum, how people predicted that interview would go and how it was at odds with how she actually did do a pretty tough interview. And then also what they learned from it. At that time, Judge Kavanaugh was getting different conflicting advice from different people that were in his friend set or group of advisors. And we kept hearing people say that there was this Bushy approach and there was a Trump approach. The Bushy approach, by the way, the people who were saying these things were sometimes, they would speak against the Bush approach, but they themselves had worked in the Bush administration. So it took us a while to figure out that what they were really talking about was an attitudinal approach. So the Bushy approach would have been to just constantly talk about how much you love women and how helpful you've been to women and talk about Christine Blasey Ford's bravery and coming out and telling her story. And the Trump approach was you fight back to defend your honor. And so he's dealing and wrestling with these different pieces of advice when he sees how the Martha McCallum interview goes and when everyone sees how that goes, they understand that that approach is not going to cut it. So it ends up being a very pivotal moment, not just to get out some new important information, such as why he knew he had not sexually assaulted someone in high school, because he was not sexually active in high school. That was actually very important information that undercut the claims that were being made, but also so he could see how different styles play on TV.
Well, his opening statement was allegedly rewritten by him the night before the retrial, not the retrial, but the Blasey Ford hearing. And it was very passionate and angry, and he teared up. And I think that was a pivotal moment. It was much better, much different, as you said, from the Martha McCallum interview. Let's talk about Dr. Blasey Ford. I call her Blasey Ford. It's just okay, so I'm snarky. But she allegedly didn't want to be known. She wanted to remain in the background. Yet before she reached out, she disappeared herself from the internet. Why? How? Everybody is online somewhere. When she came out, she was impossible to find. Talk a little bit about the build-up to her and that leaked letter to Dianne Feinstein.
Yeah, that was interesting to see how that went down because, you know, if you or I just decides to go off of Facebook, go off of Twitter, you
can 30 days or something.
You can cancel your account, but there are still remnants floating around there on the internet probably forever. This was a very thorough, very professional job of evaporating from the internet. And it was interesting to talk to people who had known her, who had been familiar with her Facebook feed, for example, and said, this isn't the person who is just, oh, maybe marginally a little left of center and just not really politically active. She actually had a very, you know, anti-Trump, very liberal take on things in that Twitter or in her Facebook feed in particular. So that's something that kind of was at odds with the portrayal in the kind of public relations side of this. The other thing that we point out, I mean, no one can tell her what is in her heart in terms of what her real goals here were, because she did say she didn't want to go on publicly with this. But it is interesting that, you know, you have this clear public relations approach to the beginning. And then you also, the first people she reached out to, according to her account, is the Washington Post tip line. And she has some texts back and forth with them. And then when they don't seem to be taking action on it, she actually says, well, I can always go to the New York Times with this. And that of course, lights a little fire under them. But that's not a typical type of behavior for someone who doesn't actually want to go public. And then, of course, the letter to Dianne Feinstein, which, again, Feinstein says she's trying to protect her confidentiality while not mentioning that there are confidential procedures for doing this. There was a whole FBI process that was literally invented for this type of situation. It was created after the Anita Hill hearings with Justice Thomas. So you could investigate claims like this and not just ignore them, but you don't have to create a media circus. You don't have to expose both accuser and the nominee to this kind of public scrutiny. And then the senators can decide whether it's something that actually has substantiation should be followed up on. That is something that she ignored. And, of course, then eventually it got leaked, whether from her office or other Democratic senators, whether from Blasey Ford's own team, we don't know. But it was a very small universe of people who had that letter.
Looking back on it, just your opinions, the circus that followed with Michael Avenatti coming out and everybody and their brother saying, oh, I remember this, and the idea of the gang rape parties that Kavanaugh was running when he was 15 years old, that hurt, I think, the cause. Would Kavanaugh have made it if it had just been Blasey Ford and not the rest of the caboose on the clown car?
I suppose it's impossible to know for sure, but I certainly think that Michael Avenatti was a key figure in advancing Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation. And we spoke with people who were highly involved in the process, who absolutely give him credit for helping Brett Kavanaugh get through. When the first allegation came out, there was no evidence in support of it, but it was at least within the realm of possible things that could have taken place on planet Earth. As the subsequent allegations come out, they get increasingly more ludicrous. And so it is worth remembering Michael Avenatti's claim, which he boasted about on Twitter, was that he had a client who had been to a series of gang rape parties where she was an adult, but that Brett Kavanaugh was underage and the victims were underage, that as an adult she didn't report these crimes against children.
And then
she went back.
Yeah, there's a lot of gang rape, but the music's really good and there's free beer.
Excellent
like, what? That doesn't make any sense.
Right, and so seeing that allegation and the absurdity of it, although It is worth noting that that was the only allegation that actually had a sworn affidavit with it. So the media like to say, oh, yeah, that one was bad, but these others were good. Actually, none of the allegations were particularly well-sourced, and I think journalists who have integrity should have been a sketch more critical of what they were hearing.
You're looking for a unicorn if you're looking for a journalist with integrity. As a journalist, and as somebody who's worked with a journalist, what would you say was the most egregious fit of journalism that you saw watching this thing unfold and looking back on it?
For me, one of the worst things that I think we saw was related to Michael Avenatti. There are really so many, and this is just one that kind of stands out right now. But NBC News actually had information that... So Michael Avenatti brought forth this claim, and he said he had a second witness who would support the claims. NBC News knew that that second witness did not support the claims, and they sat on that information. They knew it before his confirmation vote. They sat on it for weeks, only revealing it quietly weeks later.
Did they ever explain why? I haven't seen an explanation.
No, and they don't need to, because our journalists are currently in the business of giving each other awards for their bad coverage rather than firing people or holding people accountable or making sure that they, you know, promote people who are not going to follow into mob hysteria.
Carrie, you've said in interviews that the reason you wrote this is for posterity, the rewriting of the revision of history that is to come. And you referenced the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill situation. Explain that.
Yeah, so I clerked for Justice Thomas. So obviously this is a story that I'm familiar with, that most Americans who lived through that saw how those hearings played out. And it was really chilling, actually, to see the same pattern be followed again, where there's first they try to defeat him by misconstruing his record, then we have this leaked allegation, then we have a circus of a second hearing. And unfortunately, it doesn't end with, and then he got confirmed and they all lived happily ever after. At the time he was confirmed, 2-1 Americans, male, female, black, and white, believed Thomas over Hill. And ever since he was confirmed, the left didn't just go home. They continued their campaign. They tried to revise history. They tried to, continue to change and shape that narrative. So if you took those polls today, you would not see those same numbers again. The people who knew it and saw it in the time saw what was really happening, but that's not what history remembered, unfortunately. We wanted to make sure that didn't happen again, because we know they're not going home at this point. There's going to be a campaign to make this into, again, the cause célèbre of another generation. So getting the facts out there and making sure that we were well-sourced and well-researched in all of them was really important, because if Americans forget what happened here, that's the best way to encourage it to happen again. We know there's going to be more confirmations coming, and if this was what it looked like when you were replacing a swing vote on the court, imagine what it would look like if Trump was replacing, say, Justice Ginsburg or another member of the liberal bloc on the court. It would be out of control, and we need to be prepared and understand what happened so we don't allow it to happen again.
Do you think there are people on that Trump list who look at what happened to Kavanaugh and say, maybe through back channels, I appreciate it. I just don't. There's no way I can go through that.
I have to imagine that there are. It would be weird if people didn't think that after seeing what this family went through and seeing that it happened with someone like Brett Kavanaugh, who really did have this reputation that was well established over decades. You would have to imagine that it would be difficult for people. We did speak with a Supreme Court justice who pointed out that there are people who, you know, lose limbs in service of their country all the time. And if you're not willing to stand up to a tough confirmation battle, that maybe the court isn't for you. In a way, it is the ultimate test for that courage issue that you brought up that President Trump was looking for. Not just having the right judicial philosophy, not just having the record, but do you have the courage of your convictions to stand through? That's becoming one of the most important issues of our age, and unfortunately, a confirmation process that should have some level of decorum might be the ultimate test of that.
Lastly, for both of you, about Justice on Trial, just tell me what you want people to know from this book. It's a substantial book. Most books are about 100 pages less than, having written one, it's about 100 pages less than this. There's a lot of footnotes, a lot of research. But you have an idea when you hand this to somebody or you know somebody buys it, you hope that when they turn that last page, they go, this is what I want to stick with them. What do you want to stick with them?
Well, one of the things that I was impressed to learn was the level of coordination that was happening on the left. Again, you think this is not just a spontaneous movement that came up. There were groups on the left who shockingly were admitting out loud to having flown people in, to giving them the messaging points so that they were all on the same message.
I mean, it wasn't organic.
One of them even said, look, this isn't chaos.
Touch my pearls.
This is scripted. And so, but a lot of people, I think, assumed it was a lot more organic than it was. And then you had even senators who admitted, were saying things that clearly showed them cooperating with that, saying, oh, wasn't it great that we had Blasey Ford wearing a blue dress to invoke Anita Hill's own teal dress. So I think it's just they let the mask slip. I think we just need to go in with eyes wide open and not be willing to be fooled by another, public relations campaign if this kind of thing happens again.
As this book has been out, we've been hearing from people who've read it and read it quickly, which is really amazing. And I love hearing what they take out of reading this. And they each take different things. If it's remembering about media malpractice, if it's remembering about some of the dirty tricks engaged in by politicians. This is a very personal thing, but my sister was telling me as she was reading it that she was thinking about just how everything you do matters and how just normal citizens, how their votes matter and how we hold people accountable matters. And I think that's a really important thing. You touched on this earlier. If people forget this history, it allows it to continue and to be on guard against it in the future. People who went through the Thomas hearings were on guard for this. People who went through these hearings need to be on guard for what's about to come, and being informed is the first step of a long list of things that we need to do.
Molly Hemingway, Carrie Severino. Said it right.
Yep. Yes.
Justice on Trial, the book is out now. They're going to sign these books for you, one for me, two for you. You just have to email Derek@dailycaller.com, put in the message and the subject line that you want to be entered to win it. And if you've bought a copy, send me a screen capture of your receipt and you'll be entered twice. Thank you both for coming in. Congratulations with the book.
Thank you.
I'll ask you what everybody asked me when my book first came out. When's the next one? Not in a hurry.
We did so much in such a little period of time. Yeah, we've been getting that already. It's like, well, let's let this one set for a while.
Let it sink in.
Let it digest. Live a little. Congratulations on the book.
You.
We'll see you guys on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.